I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Take me away. Take me today.
Yeah, welcome to episode 37. This week, we talk to film director Jeremiah Kipp. Check out his work at kippfilms.com, because it is good. Link in the show notes as usual. Okay, I don't want to give away the whole episode, but there's a lot about directing. There's a lot that pertains to everybody that has a professional life, which I hope is you, because we all got to earn money somehow. So, if you have a professional life, how do you merge that with your personal life? This is just an all-around good episode. It encompasses a lot. But being that it's about mainly movies, I'd like to plug the iPhone, iPad app, AudioFix, for videos. Download it for free. It automatically cleans and boosts the volume in all your videos, because I'm sick of videos that I can't hear. I can't turn my phone up anymore. I don't want to have to cup the speaker. So download AudioFix for videos. It's free to try. Check it out. And enjoy this episode. I'm Gary Levitt with Matt Kaplan and Jeremiah Kipp. Yeah! Jeremiah Kipp.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So the last couple guests we had, last guest we had was a 35-year-old virgin, and the guest before that, her mom was a sex worker.
Well, I'm going to go home then. How can I compete with that?
Are you a virgin?
No.
Okay. Was your mom a sex worker?
No, not to my knowledge.
Okay. Where do we begin then?
My gosh.
No, you're actually a great film director. And I watched a bunch of your stuff online.
Oh, thank you.
Very impressive.
Thank you.
Very impressive. I noticed that you had all actors of all ages, but I was wondering if it was odd to direct older people.
Wow, that's a great question.
So, actually,
I love directing older people and little kids. I mean, they're the best actors, because older actors, like, if you've got like an experienced older actor, they'll walk into the room and they'll have nothing to prove. They're immediately relaxed because they've been there, they've done that,
right?
And you know, and they have that sort of attitude of like, I'm just gonna do this. And it's much the same way as like when you have little children, they can pick up a stick and it's a magic wand, and then it's a knife, and then it's a gun, and then it's back to being a stick again in like 1 second, because their imagination is so fertile.
Yeah,
you know, but they're also so relaxed. I mean, a kid can effortlessly go into like the magic of make-believe and then go back to being a kid again. And an older person, you know, has a similar quality, because they have nothing to prove in their lives, so they can effortlessly go into playing the senator, you know, and then go back to being Bill, you know, in like 2 seconds.
Yeah, well, you're a young guy.
Thank you. I'll take it.
Relatively.
Yeah.
But, you know, do you ever feel like, oh, who am I to, this person has more experience on sets, who am I to tell this person what to do?
No, I've never felt that, because I feel like I'm doing a job and a service, you know, and I'm working with somebody. So it's not like I'm they're my collaborator. They're like my ally, hopefully, you know, and I don't know, but there's a funny story though about John Huston directed his father, Walter Huston, in Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And they asked him, what's it like directing your father? And he said, on the film set, the director is the father, which I thought was really compelling. I don't know if I feel that way, but
is that why they had the scene of him cutting his cock off?
Oh my gosh. Pretty wild, right?
So, because I would imagine an older actor might have an ego about it, like, oh, who is this guy to tell me what to do? I got more experience.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's like I wondered that about working with, like, you know, the quote unquote name actors, you know, who come in. So, like, I remember that I had to direct an actor named Tom Sizemore, who was in Natural Born Killers, and he's been directed by Spielberg and Ridley Scott and. Mm. You know, all these great Michael Mann, all these great filmmakers. So I did have that moment of like, who am I to direct this guy? You know, I mean, you know, he's an interesting, colorful character in his own right. But what put me at ease right away was that he was nervous. You know, I mean, he kind of came in and was like, I mean, in our correspondence before he even came on to do the job, he was like, I want to do a good job for you guys, you know, and it's like, but he wants to do a good job for us. You know, it's like, I want to do a good job for him. But he came in and like very, and you know, his friend was there and it very quickly became obvious that yes, he is Tom Sizemore. He's a great actor, but he's also Tommy from Detroit who calls his mother, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, once you know that, then so you're kind of like, he's just a guy who you're collaborating with. He does the exact same thing all other actors do. Only he gets there faster because he's more experienced.
Now, when you say he's just Tommy from Detroit who calls his mother, is that your way of just making him just another human like all of us?
No, literally, you know, his friend called him Tommy and he is from Detroit and he had to call his mother when he was on the set. So like, so no, that's not me trying to bring him down to my level. That's just literally stuff that he did that made me say, you know, I mean, here he is and here am I and we're here today and we're doing our jobs and he knows his lines and he was wonderful. You know, he was really great. He's got a reputation for being a total nutcase. And, you know, he had a dark period in his career where he was, just smoking some really bad rock for a while, but he seems to have turned a corner. I mean, the guy that I met was there, ready to work and ready to play. And
is there good rock? You
know, I would assume not. Well, whatever. If there is, then he didn't see it.
I think it starts off good and slowly gets worse. I think he documented that. Didn't he?
He did. Yeah. Oh, sure. Like, he's been on reality.
Crackhead, yeah.
He did that. He wrote a book. I mean, he's done his, you know, all that stuff. So, but he seems to have turned a corner. I mean, he was just on Twin Peaks working with David Lynch. So. That's not bad company to keep.
Yeah. So he's worked with some of the top directors.
Oh, for sure.
And were you humbled by that? Like maybe he knows better than you?
Well, I certainly wanted to listen to anything that he had to say. You know, but then, you know, when you're working with somebody, I don't even think it gets into who knows better. It's more like whoever has the best idea wins. You know, it's like, I mean, if he comes in with a great idea, then, you know, like let's take the great idea. If anybody comes in with a great idea, then as a director, you take their good idea and it becomes yours, you know?
So you're open to actors giving their ideas?
I am, you know, and then when I direct an actor, I never say, no, you need to do it this way. It's like, I might play it more like, you know, that's great. Now, why don't we try it this way? You know? So, and also you're doing multiple takes, you know, it's not just take one and you're done. You know, it's like take two, you might want to do a variation. So you're like, that's great. Now, why don't we try one as if, you know, but, you know, give them a different verb to play.
See, that's the psychology coming into play when you're like, oh, that's great. Let's try it this way.
For sure. Oh, yeah.
Because that also means, I don't like it. Let's try it this way.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, but it's like a soft way of saying that because I could be wrong, too. I've certainly been wrong in the editing room and I've seen take one. I'm like, oh, yeah, take two, three, and four were rubbish, you know. Yeah. Let's go with his or her choice. You know, that's always why I give the actor the first choice. You know, it's like, take one, always without direction. So let's see what you're going to do. And then they'll do variations, sometimes just to have other options when you're cutting stuff together in the editing room. Because nobody, if you're doing a feature film, I mean, nobody can see the whole movie in their head. And if they do say that, they're lying. Because in the editing room, it's a mosaic, and you're putting these pieces together. And if you have options for a scene, if the actor has played it a couple of different ways, then you can shape the story in a slightly different way. So it's always good to get variations. Then the last take, I'll almost always give it to the actor and say, why don't you try something else? You know, surprise me.
And as an actor,
I mean, that's
such a gift when a director does that. And Jeremiah, you're great with that. It feels like so comforting and so inspiring to say, do your thing. How does it feel? Mm-hmm. And then you go from there and it's great. to be on set.
Yeah, well, I've worked with you twice, Matt. Yeah. I mean, like, well, I'm glad you had a good experience, you know. I mean, to me, it's just like, we're just playing make-believe when we were, when we were doing our thing together. It was just like, okay, you're a zombie today,
right?
You know, or you're running from the zombies today, or whatever it is.
One or the other, usually.
Yeah.
So how, when you're casting, how important is the actor's acting ability, or ability to be directed, or just ability to work with others in that creative environment?
Wow, that's also a great question. I think that's what I look for when I'm auditioning. You know, it's like
all three.
Yeah, you know, you want to. Well, you just want to see, because every actor is different, every person is different, and every actor is different. Every actor comes from a different place.
Yeah, and the unique. We'll get to this question, but the unique thing about being an actor is that there's not many other creative forms where you're being told what to do. Or, you know, usually as a musician or a stand-up comedian, you just do your thing.
Sure.
And you're your only critic.
Yeah.
But as an actor, you do it, but then ultimately someone else is having the say.
Yeah, that's the difference between movies and theater. In the theater, I think the actor ultimately is the editor. You know, the actor is on stage for 2 hours or whatever it is, you know. So the director, at a certain point, I hear in the rehearsal process, gets gently pushed away. Because, like, you know, if Jessica Lange and Gabriel Byrne are doing Long Day's Journey Into Night, there's no cut, you know. They're just doing it for however long Eugene O'Neill's play is, you know. And in movies, it's different, where, you know, you're there on that day, you know, whatever you're bringing to the table that day is what's there. And you might be working with actors who are entirely different in their process. I know I was assistant directing a couple years ago a wonderful film called Live, L-I-V. And we had two older actors who were both very experienced. This one guy was Harris Yulin, who was in Scarface, great actor. He's a Juilliard guy. So he walked into the room. It was his character's office. He's looking in the desk drawers, like he's touching all the props on the desk. He's making sure he knows what everything is because it's his office. I mean, he's not even going to open the desk in the scene, but he's just like checking to see what's there. And the other guy is Frankie Faison, who was on The Wire. He's a great actor. He's in Do the Right Thing. He's been in a million movies. And he comes in and he sort of just barely looked at the script. He's kind of, he doesn't really know all of his lines yet. He's kind of like, what are my lines today? These? All right. Okay, fine. And then, like, Frankie was hilarious because Harris is very serious, and Frankie was like, acting is silly. You know, cooking is serious. Acting is ridiculous. Acting is stupid. And I think he did that so that he could relax.
Right.
So you got these two different guys coming at it from two different schools of thought in a scene together. And then, you know, like once they start acting together, it's like, it doesn't matter that they're coming at it from two different processes. They're playing together. And then the director is playing with them, you know? And I think that's all you would want from an actor as a director, is like somebody who comes ready to play, who's done their homework or has done enough life homework that they bring their life experience to the set. Somebody who's there to create with you and like have a, you know, having a good time thing is actually less important to me, because it's nice to have a good time. It's better to have a good time than not have a good time. But the audience doesn't really care if you had a good time or not, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, all they're seeing is like what's in the frame in that shot and the next shot and the next shot after that. So you guys had a miserable day and everybody was screaming at each other and it was a hostile work environment and all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, that doesn't matter. If the performances are there, the story is being told and the audience is enjoying what they're seeing, they don't know that it was a nightmare on the set that day.
And you could also easily placate an actor by being like, oh yeah, let's do your idea, and then just not use it in the editing room.
For sure. You know, I mean, that is a tactic for sure. But I think it's, instead of looking at it as like, I'm going to dismiss your idea, it's like, I'm going to take your idea. Mm-hmm. We have your idea now. Take one as your idea.
Right.
That's great. You know, and now let's try mine. You know, if you give me your idea, you know, I think, you know, an actor will respect you if you give them the opportunity to let them play, let them show you what they have.
And it also frees them creatively.
Absolutely. And also you might get inspired by that. You might see what they're doing and then be like, oh, that's great. Now, why don't we add this, you know, or whatever. I think that's, you know, that's the fun of it, I think, is like that act of discovery. And also that I could be wrong. You know, it's like, I'm not afraid to admit that I'm wrong. If like an actor gives something and it's like, oh, that's not what I wanted. And then the editing room, you discover that is in fact what we needed, you know.
So is this part of your auditioning process? Are you hoping that they'll bring something that to the table that you might not think of, and you also obviously want to be able to work well with them?
I like to be surprised, you know. I like it when an actor comes into the room and first in the audition process, same thing. I'll like say, show me what you have, and like, let's say Matt's auditioning for me, I'd have Matt play it, and then I'll be like, great, now why don't we try it? And I might do something that's totally contrary to the scene. If the scene is like, I love you, I love you, then I might say, Matt, that's great, now let's try one where it's like, it's as if you just want to get out of the room, you know, when you're saying, I love you, I love you. You just want to get out of there just to see if they can take a direction and play it.
Right.
You know? So then you can see if they have range. Then you can see if they're directable. You can see if they only do their one thing and that's it. Sometimes one thing and that's it is all you need. Sometimes an actor will come in and they do the one thing and that's all they're good at. They can only play their limited range, but that's all you need from it, you know, and you don't need anything more. So, but you know, it's good to know what those limits are, you know, through the audition process. When I haven't auditioned, you know, then it's like, you know, you either try somebody out in a really, really, really small part and then see if they've got, like Matt, you know, Matt was, you know, like a zombie the first time I worked with him. And I was like, wow, Matt is really, really great to work with. You know, so then I was doing a music video and I was like, hey, Matt, you want to be like the lead in this music video? Because I knew that he was fun on the set, great to work with, collaborative, you know, all that stuff. I knew that I could direct him. So he didn't have to audition for that. He just had to show up and be great, you know?
Right.
Show up and be Matt.
All right.
That's the worst part of that.
Have you ever been on set, you've cast someone, and then it strikes you like, oh no, this isn't the right person?
I'll tell you something that did happen. I worked with an actor who I'll politely keep, I'll have him remain nameless for God's sake. But I worked with him and it was a really, really engaging shoot. I was assistant directing. He was really good. And it was one of those things, he was an older actor and it was like, oh wow. I mean, he's still got it. So then I was like, well, why don't we bring him in for this other project? And then he came in on the day and was like, didn't know what movie he was in. Didn't know...
He didn't read the script?
Didn't know his... He read the script on the treadmill that morning, but he read the opposite part, which was the woman's part. You know, so he sort of knew the lines for the woman, you know.
The subconscious is a bitch.
Yeah. So he showed up and didn't know what planet he was on, really, you know. And it was one of those, like, okay, all right, here we go. It's going to be this today. This is what we have today. So then I just counted on the fact that he's been in a million movies and was kind of like, all right, we're just going to get through this thing somehow, you know, and he blamed everybody else for his problems. He's like, oh, my agent got me the wrong script and oh, this and that, the other thing. And it, you know, the crew just hated his guts.
What were his problems?
I think his problems were that he's, you know how we exist on the planet Earth and some people seem like they exist on the planet Pluto. That was his problem, I think, because he was just like...
But creatively, that can be a good thing sometimes.
It wound up being a good thing in the editing room, because his performance was so weird.
Right.
And that was the thing. Like, that's why we cast him, was this was a very exposition-heavy role, which is essentially explaining things. Here's the plot, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, well, if we get this weird actor in there, at least it'll be like Gonzo is giving us the exposition, you know, because Gonzo on The Muppet Show was a weirdo, you know? So it's like, we certainly got that. In the editing room, we cut it together. I was dreading it the whole time, being like, this guy was so horrible to work with. And I really, you know, we went out and got drunk afterwards because it was like, that was the only way to numb the pain of like the anguish of like working with a total jackass. I mean, he was like grabbing the crew by their legs and like sort of like blowing trumpet sounds before the other act. Like, let's say we were filming Matt right now, like before, like, so I'd be like, roll camera, action. And then this actor would be like, "Pakaw!" Like right before I was to say his lines, to throw Matt off so that we would have to cut to the older actor. Anyway, in the editing room, it wound up working out okay because his performance is so weird and colorful. And
but wait. Yeah. Is that even productive?
No, it's horrible. And he's been doing that for 20 years because like I've read about him and he was doing that on movies a million years. This is not Tom Sizemore, by the way. This Tom Sizemore was wonderful and brilliant and great.
This is during his crack period.
No, this is not Tom I'm talking about. This is a different actor. But, you know, but... he was just a whack job. But I mean, but I will say that in, you know, you watch the movie and you watch and you do say like, boy, that guy is a whack job, but he is funny as heck to watch. And that is the thing that we discovered in the edit. It was like, all right, you know what? The guy is a first class weirdo, but at least it livens up the scene. I mean, the scene is not boring to watch. It seems like a, you know, a strange bird has flown into the movie for a couple of minutes and then flies back out again. But it's certainly, I mean, it was certainly fun and livened up the day. Now, it wasn't much fun for me. It wasn't much fun for the actor who was playing opposite him. And it wasn't much fun for the crew who had to put up with all of his crap all day, you know, like, whatever. It's that was not a good day, but it wound up being okay in the edit.
Well, this is all stuff that goes into the casting.
Oh, sure.
You know, like you hear stories of Brando being very difficult.
Oh, yeah.
On set.
And totally.
Who's the guy that plays Lincoln?
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
He liked to be called Mr. President on the set.
Yeah, method acting. He never broke character.
Sure.
Even off.
Yeah. Screen. You know, and I mean, I'm down with a method actor, you know, if they want to come in and be, you know, Stanley Kowalski all day, that's fine if they're great on camera. If they can embody that in the movie, fine. I mean, if somebody causes a lot of trouble but are worth the trouble that they cause, then I'm okay with that. You know, it's like I can deal with that. And, you know, especially if it's only for a limited window of time. Like, if they're on there for a day, it's okay. If they're on it for 3 weeks and they're methoding out for 3 weeks, it's like, okay. But I think at a certain point, you know, even that, they're going to get used to the rhythm of the movie and they'll know when, you know, when the method stuff is getting in the way of the flow of productivity. Because that happened, you know, like years ago, I worked with a real actor studio, method actory guy. And like, it, you know, in the beginning, it was just like crazy. It's like, do you really need an hour to do the insert shot of you lifting up the postcard? Mm-hmm. You know, and on day one with him, I was like, this guy is crazy. I mean, how can we deal with this for 3 weeks?
And you didn't know that before he was
I mean, you know, we knew he was that guy, but I mean, we also knew he was worth it because he was great in the movie. He holds the whole movie together. He's wonderful. But it was a pain in the ass, you know. It was like definitely like irritating to be there, like sitting around like watching him be like, now we're walking down the hallway, let's say he's acting with Matt. All right, Matt and I are walking down the hallway, but I don't want to walk side by side with him because I don't trust him. And I don't want to walk ahead of him because I don't want him behind me. I don't like the feeling of him. He could sneak up on me. And I don't want to be behind him because that makes him dominant. So how can we walk down this hallway together? And that's when you know.
It's just overthinking.
And that's when the director has to just, you know, at some point, you know, there's a great, I remember on this, one of my favorite films is Don't Look Now. And it was directed by a really great British director named Nicholas Rogue, and he was working with Donald Sutherland, a brilliant actor. Sutherland's on the phone with him like before they start production, and he's like, look, I think the ending of the movie, my character should really be redeemed and should have an epiphanous moment, blah blah blah, you know, all this other stuff that has nothing to do with the ending of the movie. I won't give away the ending. The ending is a shocking ending and it's quite brilliant, but the director just kind of didn't answer his question. Sutherland felt this awkward silence on the phone. The director finally just said, do you want to do this movie or don't you? Uh-huh. And I was like, yes, yes, you know, and Sutherland was like, yes, sir. Yes, I'll do whatever you say. And then, you know, sometimes it is that, you know, sometimes if it is like, you know, if it is somebody who's doing something that is so bonkers, you know, that you just have to sit there and have the nerve of steel and be, and I mean, sometimes that is directing too. And you have to just say like, are we going to do this or not? You know, because at the end of the day, it's like, what are we doing? You know, what are we doing here?
It's, well, it seems to me like method acting, as an actor, I feel like you should be able to turn it on and turn it off.
I mean, I love that. I mean, those are my favorite kinds of actors. If you can turn it on and turn it off and be collaborative in between, that's wonderful. That is the best. I mean, because then you have an ally and a friend with you.
To me, that, I mean, I'm you know, I'm not like a big actor or anything, but it seems to me like that's the skill.
Well, I think that is it. It's like, you know, we talked about the kid before. I mean, make believe and then reality are two different things, you know. I mean, even Mike Lee, who does these, he's this British filmmaker who does these like sort of immersive, you know,
because the plays, right?
He does films where they develop them through improvisations and stuff like that. But he always
Abigail's
Party. Yeah. So he did a lot of theater, you know. But he always does this thing where he tells the actors come out of character so they can, you know, so they can talk about the characters objectively and, you know, and look at it three-dimensionally instead of being in it all the time. And I think that's great. I mean, those are certainly my favorite kinds of actors to work with who can be in it during the take and then can come out of it. And then, you know, if you need something really simple, like, hey, I just need you to open up a little bit more towards the camera so I can see your face more or whatever, you know, whatever technical direction it is, they can make those kind of adjustments as well.
Yeah. I think also it just gives everybody time to relax and bond with each other and build trust between fellow actors and crew and director.
Yeah. But Matt, how important is that to you, the idea of like building a relationship with your fellow actors?
I think it's very important. Yeah. And, you know, maybe for other people, it doesn't matter. But for me, I need to feel comfortable and have trust with my other actors and director to be able to feel like I can take chances and do whatever I need to do and won't be judged that everybody has my back there.
Yeah, that's a big, big part of it. Yeah. As a creative person, I think working with other people that you feel are supportive is so helpful. Like, I used to play in a band.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, there was a time when my bass player at the time he wanted us to start singing his songs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very subconscious thing, but I started to like choke up. My throat started to choke up. And I realized like he wasn't supporting, he just wanted to be lead singer.
Yeah.
And I stopped being able to sing with him in the band. It was very weird.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a physical reaction.
I was having a physical reaction to the mental struggle of that. Yeah.
So then how did you ultimately find your way through that?
We just broke up the band.
Oh, wow. That's easiest. Not as easy when you started filming something.
Okay, guys, the shoot's off. Everybody go home.
Well, have you ever had to do that? Be like, all right, you're not working out, buddy.
Like replace somebody or fire them? I'm sure I have had to. I can't remember off the top of my head, but like I try to make it a rarity because you want to, you know, you're making a company, you know, and you want to have all the right people in there. I don't know. Off the top of my head, I can't remember firing somebody. I have had moments that are like awkward where you wind up cutting an actor out of a movie, not because the performance is bad necessarily, but because it doesn't fit with the flow of the story. So I've done that occasionally where I have to call up an actor and be like, hey, I'm really sorry, but your scene got cut. And, you know,
and it's really because they're an asshole?
No, it's because, you know, I mean, often it's because the, you know, in the flow of the narrative, that scene becomes extraneous, you know, and like there's a movie called Waking the Dead, and Ed Harris had like a big 8-minute scene in that, and it got cut out, and they had to call him and be like, Ed, I'm sorry, you know, and that's a tough phone call to make, but like, I would never cut somebody because they were an asshole. I mean, them being an asshole has very little bearing on whether they're a good actor or not. I mean, it has bearing on how fun they are to hang out with or whatever, you know. And I wouldn't necessarily want to work with somebody who's an asshole again, because there are many talented people. You might as well work with people that you like. Matt, let's get back to the thing you were talking about before, which was the trust thing. Because on our music video, Matt and I did a music video a couple weeks ago. It was by a band called Suit of Lights, and the music video is called Break Open the Head. And there's a bit where like Matt is being pinned down, and like you're getting this elaborate helmet being put on you, and stuff is being stuck up your nose and stuff like that. Yeah. You know. And I'm just curious about your safety. I mean, if I were an actor, I would be a little worried about 10 people pinning me down and sticking shit in my face.
Well, Matt likes that, actually.
I think a few things. One is I knew you previously, and we have a lot of mutual friends, so I had, at this point, complete trust in you. So I knew you were there.
Yeah.
So I wasn't, you know, terribly worried. I knew if there was anything going really bad, you would have stopped it. I had spent time with a lot of the people at that point just that day.
Before,
so I felt okay. I mean, I didn't know all of them, but they all seemed like good people. So I had trust there.
Were you, like, scared physically? Is that what
I wasn't scared physically, but it was definitely uncomfortable. I mean, there was a lot of people pretty much manhandling me as I was falling into this. I mean, at some point, you just have to trust that this is going to work out. And, you know, if I'm not completely throwing myself into it, it's going to show, especially in that scene, that I was like, this is, we're creating something here. So I'm just going to trust my fellow actors and Jeremiah and everyone else around and hope for the best. I mean, what's the worst that can go wrong is, you know, someone slammed something up my nose a little too hard, but it didn't happen. They were all very careful. And I can see even when we were running through rehearsals of it that we did like a couple of times, everyone was very careful, you know, to be careful with me and not hurt me and support me in that way.
He makes it sound like he's getting waterboarded.
Well, I mean, it was intense. It was certainly intense, but it was something I really liked, you know, because we did this thing where we tried out these helmets and weird stuff beforehand, and you were very vocal about, like, if it felt uncomfortable or anything. I mean, you would speak up, so, you know, so we did our best to try to accommodate that, because, I mean, you know, it's an important thing, actually, when you're on a movie set. It's like, safety first is a critical thing. I mean, that is more, actor safety is more important to me than any film ever made, including Blade Runner, which is a great movie, you know? It's like, an actor needs to be safe, you know, an actor needs to be safe. And usually, like, horror movies or science fiction movies or really dark dramas and stuff like that will involve a certain amount of physicality, you know. I mean, no more than rugby or basketball or something like that, you know.
Or dating.
But, yeah, or dating, which is a minefield in and of itself. But, you know, it's like, but you want to do everything possible to keep the actor safe. I mean, for many reasons. One is, like, you want the actor to, like, walk away in one piece 100% at the end of the day, you know.
But what if they die on set while you're filming? I mean, isn't that a gift?
If they die on set while we're filming, that would be called a snuff film.
I will say my legs were sore at the end of the day.
Well, you were running like crazy.
I was doing a lot of running. I'm not in the best shape. I should have stretched more.
Yeah, I heard those stories on like 28 weeks later. Jeremy Renner was always talking about like, yeah, today we just did more running.
Yeah.
I mean, for weeks, all I've been doing is running and running and running and running. I mean, it's pretty physical.
One other thing I will say about that is, yes, it's finding the time to bond and be comfortable with everyone around you, but also as an actor, finding the time also to get into character. And sure. I don't think, for me personally, you need to be in character for days or weeks, you know, but I did make sure that before, you hit said action that I was ready. So I would sit there and, you know, I was kind of, you know, I don't want to give away all my secrets, but but making sure I was in that emotional,
right,
physical place to be able to do what that scene needed.
How important is wardrobe to you? Like, if you put on a character, like, your character has an army jacket and all this other stuff in that. I mean, like, did that affect you at all?
I think that helps me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the same for every actor, but mm-hmm. I know, you know, I'm still fairly new, relatively new mm-hmm. to acting. So for me, sometimes that helps inform things. With the wardrobe, headgear, any kind of special effects makeup is easier to just jump into the character. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, while you're wearing it, you can't see yourself anyway. So sure. It really just does need to come from you. I think that's mm-hmm. it's a helpful crutch sometimes.
But I could see how it affects you. Like, if I wear a really bright color and mm-hmm. I'm not in the mood, if mm-hmm. I'm in a dark mood, I'll be yes. like, oh, I've got to get this shirt off.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. And I think so on set as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So as a director, one thing that's similar to, because I've been a recording engineer and I've worked with bands and musicians, and my job as a producer, I think, is similar to as a director, where I have to push people to their personal limits.
Oh yeah.
And one thing that recording engineers always say is, like, our job is like 85-90% psychology and 10% audio.
Yeah.
So do you feel like this as a director, like it's mostly a psychological game?
Well, I learned something, a really valuable tool from a music producer. Mm-hmm. I happened to be working on a documentary in a music studio, and this band was recording something, and the music producer, you know, he knew that the lead singer was totally exhausted at the end of the day. He's like, great, we're going to do one more now. And he knew that would be the best one because I was exhausted. The guy was like, nah, I don't want to do it. So then the producer, like, goes up to him, like, all right, we're going to jump up and down, you know, right now. I'm going to do it with you. We're jumping up and down together. Get your knees up in the air. Get your knees up. Get a jump to touch the ceiling, you know, whatever. And, like, the guy is exhausted and sweating and getting really angry, you know. And then the producer's like, great, now we're going to record. Growling, whatever, you know. And the guy gave, like, the best performance. I mean, it was incredible. And I was like, my God, you know, that is a tool. You know, that is a way to get the best performance out of this guy. You know, and sometimes I've used that to get an actor out of their heads. Like, if they're in their heads, I might be like, jump up and down, touch their knees to the sky. I mean, I learned that from a music producer. I thought that was brilliant.
It is, but that's a physical thing mm-hmm. that you're asking them to do, which mm-hmm. is a lot more qualitative and tangible than mm-hmm. an emotional move.
Sure.
Well, that's of them.
No, for sure. But I mean, you know, it's like that, but I think those things are all
like, if you want more sadness, you want more like more depth of emotion from someone.
Mm-hmm.
It could be tough to coax that out of them because you have to push them. And some people might not think that they can get to that limit. And I've had the experience several times of being mm-hmm. like, you push them either to beyond what they thought they were capable of, which is great when that mm-hmm. happens. And I've also had the experience of pushing them too far, where they like have a little bit of an emotional breakdown.
Wow.
Or you get the resistance, like, I can't do it. That, and they think their limits are, which is most people
mm-hmm.
think their limits are before the line of their actual limits.
Yeah, if I feel like I'm getting resistance, then like that's when I just use tricks, you know. It's like you might direct them to do something totally like that you're not even going to use. Like, great, now play it as if you're going to find gold underneath the table or something like that. And they'll think it's absurd and they'll be like, you can't be serious. Like, no, do it. You know, and then they'll do that. And then, you know, it's like, I mean, they don't even want to do it that way. But then, like, you've sort of cleared the slate and then you can give them, like, another verb, which is something you might really want. But now why don't you try this, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think if you're constantly approaching it, like, why don't you try something? Why don't we try this instead of do this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, then, like if anything you can do to take that sense of pressure away from the work environment is helpful,
right,
which is, of course, contrary to the entire nature of film production, where it's all about pressure. There's no time, there's no money.
But all right, so the scene is the uh-huh. actor, their wife just died.
Sure.
And you're not getting the real emotion out of it. Like, come on, your wife just died. Let's mm-hmm. see that emotion. And they're just not delivering. What do you do?
Well, sometimes I might just make them do it over and over and over again until they're bored, you know? And then, like, in the boredom, you know, it's like, you ever done karaoke and you're totally exhausted and then just something will happen? Like, you know, if an actor gets bored with it, then they kind of reach some epiphanous level sometimes where it, like, becomes really fascinating. You know, or I might do something where it's like, all right, everybody out of the room, you know, like, uh-huh. Just get out, you know, like, let this person be alone for a little while. You know, create, and, you know, you can do that, and that's a little trick where you're just creating isolation, you know, you're creating the sense that they're alone in the room. And if they're alone in the room, then they might be more open to the idea of, like, being vulnerable instead of being surrounded by 30 guys in baseball caps that are staring at them, you know, or whatever. Right. You know, so, you know, if you can create, like, that sense of, like, quiet where they're in their own space, and then, you know, then you'd say, like, just you don't even have to.
You ever ask them to think about something horrible, something tragic?
You know, I did that with a little kid once. He liked thinking about his dead dog for the crying scene. Uh-huh. You know, he was like, yeah, you know, my dog died. Can I think about that? I'm like, yeah, that's good. Yeah, mm-hmm. Think about your dead dog. You know, and then he got into it. He thought about his dead dog, and then he started crying. So actors, you know, sometimes they use music. They'll listen to, like, some. I was working on some science fiction movie where the actress had to cry. She was listening to music. So then the crew were, like, guessing what she was listening to. Like, is it opera? Is it really? It wound up being something really cheesy, like some sort of, like, cheesy pop song, like Gloria Estefan or something
Celine
like that.
Celine Dion.
It was Celine Dion.
Was it really?
Oh yeah. Yeah,
oh
yeah,
god.
Yeah. No.
That person.
I know. Everyone was gagging. Like, really? That's what you listened to get to the emotional depths of the scene.
That was a joke.
Like, yeah. No. I mean, yeah. We thought so too, but it was the truth. So the horrifying truth.
Has that happened to you, where you just weren't getting the depth of emotion out of somebody?
Yeah, but then you just keep going. You know, I'm relentless. You know, I will not give up on a person. You know, it's like, I will not give up on them. I you know, it's like, you're here. I believe in you. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't cast you if I didn't believe that you could get there.
You're showing support.
We're going to get there together, you know? So it's
right.
That's
the first psychological move, is to show your support.
Oh yeah. And if it takes us 2 hours for you to get to the place that you need to get to, then by God, we're going to take the 2 hours that it
takes.
But
what do you do beyond
you?
The support? You've shown the support. Now you need to push them.
Well, then that's where you get into verbs. You know, it's like, I mean, an actor can't play a feeling, they can play an action, you know, and action is, you know, is usually in the form of a verb. And, you know, it's like, I don't know if I can think of a verb off the top of my head, but, like, I mean, you know, the act of doing something is, like, mm-hmm. what enables you to, like, feel. So, yeah, I mean, another way I might have them find the emotion is, like, I might be like, all right, well, why don't you, you know, just, you know, say all that dialogue, but, like, you know, what if you're, I don't know, like, ripping pages out of the book. I mean, give them a physical action, and then that gets them out. You know, then suddenly they're not thinking about, I need to get to the emotion. They're just thinking, like, I just have to rip this newspaper into thin little pieces or something like that.
Get them out of their head.
Oh, yeah, you know. And then, like, weirdly, you know, by, like, doing this action, then they're free. You know, they're free to just feel whatever it is that they're going to feel. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, you know, there is also that thing that you're talking about of, like, I mean, I do, you know, I did work with an actress who, you know, talked about, like, being 10 years old and being humiliated by her father or something like that, you know? And so we talked about that for a really long time before her breakdown scene. She just told me that whole story. You know, she's like, this happened to me. You know, I mean, like, that is what happened. It was like, we did 5 takes and it was like not going there.
Yeah.
So then we walked away from everybody, went to another room and said, all right, everybody sit tight, have a coffee, whatever. And then, you know, I was like, you know, just tell me a story from something that happened in your life. And she told me that. And then she was really upset. And then we went, and it's like, all right, guys, get ready. You know, and it was like a SWAT team, like, swooping in, like, everybody's suddenly in position. The camera guy is there, the sound guy is there, action. And then she goes right into that place, but she wasn't going into the place that there's the character in the scene in the movie. She was going into the place of remembering being 10 and humiliated by her father. So that is a thing, you know, it's like, that is purely psychological, of, like, getting somebody to go into a place. But then at the end of it, you know, it's that thing again, that it goes back to that thing of, like, validating and supporting and stuff like that. I mean, you just give that person a hug after it's over, you know, and, like, you know, and tell them that they were great and brave and you know, and that, you know, they achieved a thing. And, you know, when an actor does that, it's like an Olympian, like, running the 100-mile dash and beating their best time or something like that. Yeah. An actor doesn't, you know, like, that stuff, like, comes and goes very freely. Like, if they go to a deep, dark place, you know, and then do the scene, you've never seen such freedom when we break for lunch. You know, they're, like, laughing and relaxed and telling stupid jokes again and stuff like that because they've accomplished something. You know, they feel a sense of, like, having done the work and done what they needed to do.
Well, I've had this experience in the studio with musicians. Like, I've had a girl have a nervous breakdown and start crying and scraping her cello strings. I've had a guy who was singing throw his guitar on the floor and run out.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just because I was pushing them to do a little more.
Yeah.
And these are the worst stories.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Right? So it's hard. That's where the psychologist comes into play, of, like, finding each person's limit. And you find creative people, everyone has blocks.
Yeah, but a director will do anything to get the performance out of the actor. Like, there was a...
But you must have run into blocks with people where you're like, all right, I've reached that person's limit. That's the best they're going to do because of their own personal blocks. Though you could sense that they have it in them if they could just get over themselves.
Yeah, but then you find a way. I mean, like, you will use every trick in your mechanism to, like, get
them in the balls.
You will do whatever you have to do. Now, I mean, like, I don't know if I would, like, hit an actor to, like, get him to cry or something like that. But, you know, but an actor asked David Cronenberg to hit her. So he's like, hits her, and then she does the emotional scene. This other actor comes in, he's like, how can you hit that actor? He's like, I don't want to. She's asking me to. You know, I hate doing it.
Yeah.
And she's like, how hard do you hit her? Hit my arm like that. And he does it. And she's like, maybe you can do it to me before the take, you know, and it'll help me. And it's just like, oh my God, actors are crazy. But, you know, and a director will do anything, you know, especially it's but that thing of like...
You personally, have you had that experience of reaching someone's personal wall? Where you knew that they can go further, but they're in their own way.
I would never... I mean, nothing comes to mind because I refuse to believe that... You know, it's like if somebody hits that wall, it's because they really want to go there, probably. You know, it's like, I mean, there's some deep thing inside of them that, like, needs to get unlocked, you know?
Right.
And then it's just like... Then it's like you just have to find the key to unlock them. And that key could be like, all right, everybody break for lunch. We're going to come back in this thing afterwards just to get them out of that moment. You know, and then we come back in and then it's kind of like, all right, great. Now let's pick it up again. Now we're starting fresh, you know, or whatever. I mean, you will do anything to get them to where they need to go. You know, and if that means humiliating myself, I will do it. You know, if it means having the other actor do something totally bonkers to, like, get the other person to go where they need to go, great. I know I've like instructed the other actor sometimes to, like, make up lines like, you really, you suck, you know, or whatever, or I don't know what. I mean, like, you know, it's like,
well, you ever feel like you have to, you ever feel like you're working with an actor where you're like, oh, I gotta wear kid gloves with this person.
Yeah, but then you're just, but you're dealing with somebody who's a delicate instrument, you know? It's like actors are vulnerable. They're exposing their vulnerabilities, so...
But isn't that inhibiting to the creative process where you have to wear those kid gloves and walk on eggshells around the person, be very careful what you say?
Well, you know, I mean, on a film set, it's like a construction site, so there's only so much that you can do that stuff, you know?
You mean, because,
like,
catcalling and...
No, it's like, it's just, I mean, you know, it's like you're building a house, you know? Right. So it's like, so you know, it's like you're there to do... a job, you know, you're there to make a movie, you know, and it's not, you know, so, like, walking on kid gloves around somebody, unless it's going to help them give the performance that they need, then, you know, and then you will tell everybody, you'll be like, all right, listen, guys, you can't, you know, everybody has to speak in a whisper today because Matt Kaplan needs to find the emotional depths to play the scene. And then everybody will, you know, the film crew will do it because they just want to, you know, they're like, fine. If we all need to whisper for Matt to give his performance, great. If the actor needs the friggin' water with lemons in it, with the seeds taken out of the lemons to give the performance, then do that. You know, whatever it takes, as long as it's legal, you know, like, do what you need to do.
You ever have someone have a nervous breakdown or start to cry on set because they hit their point?
Yeah, but usually I'll film that, you know? I mean, like, if they're having a nervous breakdown, I will film that shit.
That's quality, you know? B-roll right there.
Oh, dude, I mean, that's going in the movie, you know? That's because that's real, you know? It's right. Like, I mean, that's, why not? I mean, that's like... but that's a trick too. It's like, you know, if they're at their limit and then they're breaking down. I mean, that's Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon. He was like breaking down during one of the scenes and the director's like, keep filming, you know? So, that's, you're capturing life there when that stuff is happening. It's like, let it be real, you know, let it happen.
Is this like every director, from what I've read, seems to have their own process for casting. Mm-hmm. Like Woody Allen just kind of trusts the actors a lot. Do you have your own sort of process that you use?
Yeah, well, I like to see them come in, and I like to get a sense of who they are, and I like to get a sense of if they like to, you know, if they're versatile, if they like to play, if they're open to exploring. You know, if they come in and they have their one way of doing something, then often I'm not too interested. I like people who are there to collaborate, you know? I like people who are there to play. I also like people who are brave, you know, who are fearless, because I like doing stuff that's really dark and really goes to a deep, dark place, you know. And I like working with actors who are unafraid of going to that deep, dark place, you know, who are fearless about diving into that deep end of the pool, but who in a, who they themselves are, you know, also able to pull themselves out of it. You know, I wouldn't want to work with an actor who goes to the deep, dark place and then lives in the deep, dark place, you know, and is deep, dark and insane, like while we're doing our work.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's not really what you want, you know.
Now, how important is it for an actor to have experienced that in real life as a person?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if someone grew up, someone's like 24, they're mm-hmm. sheltered, they grew up a very middle class, safe neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how are they able to bring that sort of depth to the camera?
Well, it depends how strong their inner life is, you know, because David Lean grew up in the suburbs and it was very boring and he was dreaming about Lawrence of Arabia, you mm-hmm. know. So if that 24-year-old sheltered kid has an imaginative inner life, you know, who, you know, can, because I believe that we can imagine ourselves to be like, you know, much larger than we are. Our dream life and our inner life is like profound, you know, if we allow ourselves to express that,
yeah.
you know. So that sheltered 24-year-old, you know, could have like inner, like deep pools of bubbling, you know, stuff going on inside.
So are
of
you
them.
Saying that there's not all that of a direct correlation?
Well, I don't, not necessarily. I mean, if somebody comes into the room and I feel like they're boring and have no inner life, then I'm probably not going to cast them, you know? Right. If I feel like an actor is just playing it safe and, you know, I think my least favorite thing is that, you know, like, and it's actually a thing with a lot of actors is they want to be liked, you know. It's like, I don't know if my character is likable, you know. And it's like, why, don't worry about the character being likable. Why be likable when you could be interesting,
right?
You know.
Oh, that's, and so now, like, ever since Tony Soprano, I feel like all the lead characters are pretty unlikable.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a thing, you know. But you know, an actor, you know, but many actors, and even great ones that I've worked with, you know, like fantastic actors, they're like, I don't know, do you think they will just hate me? And it's like, don't, you know, just play it for truth, you know, play mm-hmm. the truth of the character.
And even if they're hating the character, they're not hating
you.
Yeah,
they're not hating you, you know. I mean, it's like, just play the truth of the character. And then they will react to that, you know. It's like, I mean, we don't watch Macbeth and be like, I can't watch this play. Mm-hmm. Macbeth is so unlikable, because we relate to it. He's ambitious, you know. He wants something, you know. He's like, I really want to be the king, and boy, would it be great if my life worked out okay, you know. And it's like, I am the king. And it's like, oh, man. Being the king sucks.
I think most actors will find that once they do play that unlikable character, that it's a lot more fun than playing likable characters.
Oh, sure. The villain gets all the tasty, gets a tasty role.
Roles going on, yeah.
For sure. Alan Rickman made a career out of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting is more interesting than nice. That's
oh, yeah, my gosh. And nice, I mean, like in the dating world, my God, nice is probably the most lethal word. Oh, you're really nice.
Yes, of death.
It's like, boy,
you're like my brother.
Yeah, it's like, just shoot me. You know, it's like a nice.
Yeah, no, nice is not good.
No, man, you don't want to be nice. Stay out of the friend box.
Have you been called a nice guy, Jeremiah?
I've been called kind, but I try to stay out of the nice friend box. I mean, I'm not. You know, it's like that's not really my thing. You know, it's like I care really deeply about what I'm doing, and then I will do what I need to do to get that thing done, you know. And that means sometimes you can't be nice. I mean, sometimes you have to push. Sometimes you have to be a dick, you know. I mean, sometimes you have to just be like, no, we gotta keep going, you know. It's like, we all want to go home. It's
and you
like,
know what, yeah. Sometimes when you're a dick to a person, it frees them.
Exactly.
Because they're like, oh, thank God this person's a dick, now I could just be
right
a dick too.
Totally. Right. Exactly. You know, and that can totally, you said, opens things up. I mean, that can totally open things up. And if somebody gets angry, then that can like open up a whole flood of interesting things.
Yeah.
So that's great. I mean, but that's another tool in the toolbox, you know. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, being nice to somebody, like being nice to an actor doesn't necessarily serve them. Being kind to an actor, I think, can serve them. You know, it's like, I mean, letting them know that you're with them can serve them.
Yeah, I'm not so good at that kind of stuff. I'm very blunt and, you know, honest to a fault sometimes.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's interesting because, you know, you gotta somehow find the right people.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why you work with a lot of the same people, because you know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, that's trust. You know, it's like if you trust the person completely, then you will push yourself further. You know, it's like I know myself, if I'm surrounded by a cast that I think is great and a crew that I think is great, and we're shooting in a location that I think is great, then I will push myself further. You know, it's like I will dare myself to do all sorts of crazy stuff, because it's like, what are we here for? They're here to do the same old thing? No, let's do something better than that. Let's do something more exciting than that.
You like when an actor listens to what you're saying, and it's like, well, what if we do this? Or what if I play it like that?
And then I will often give them the opportunity to try that, you know? Like,
isn't that more interesting and fun for you?
Oh, yeah. Than be,
okay.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Sometimes it's the best. I mean, you feel like you're watching them, you know, it's like if you're standing by the monitor and you're like, yeah, try that. And then they're doing their thing. It's like, man, I just feel like I'm watching a movie right now. That's all I'm doing.
You know what
it is? Watching a movie.
Working with musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I hate when people have no artistic vision.
Yeah.
When they're just like, okay, yeah, that sounds good. Okay, that's great. I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like,
yeah, you want some pushback, actually.
Totally.
Pushback is good, because then something can grow, you know? But if they're like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Yeah, whatever. You know? It's like, it will almost always be like, eh.
Yeah. You know? I love it when they're like, yeah, but I was thinking more like this. Then I'm like, now you're stoking the fire.
Absolutely. That's exactly it.
But it is finding that line, like you had mentioned, the actor that was like, you know, overly careful and wanted to take an hour just to pick up a card.
Oh, yeah.
Of finding that. How much is this about me, and how much of it is about, like, you know, just something that will improve it? And especially, I know as an actor, sometimes the director, the filmmaker can be distracted by something technical and just for not pick up on something that might be obvious, you know, that the actor realizes, because the actor's been in that character all day, of like, oh, didn't I hurt myself last scene? Shouldn't I be limping the scene? And like, you know, the director might be like, oh, of course.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so glad you caught that.
No, but you can't take your eye off of the ball for 1 second with anything. I mean, with the camera, with the actors, with the sound, with the, you know, like the music, whatever it is. I mean, if you take your eye off the ball for 1 second, you will regret it forever.
Yeah.
You know, if something happens with an actor and you just let it pass, you're just gonna, that's fine. Then you will watch that movie forever. And like, you know, and look at that shot and be like, oh, yeah, that's when I let my eye off the ball for 1 second. Mm-hmm. And I let that wardrobe thing happen. And now I have to look at that forever. And I know it was wrong. It was just because I was lazy and let it pass.
It is such a difficult balance, whether you're producing music or directing a film, that you do have to balance the technical with the artistic all at the same time. And sometimes there can be so many things happening at once.
Yeah, but I think that's the joy of it.
Oh, of course. But it's the challenge and the joy,
But I also think the technical and the artistic are the same, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like they are the same thing. You know, if you're working with a director of photography, you know, it's not just like, you know, plastic and metal. I mean, like, it's like, you know, the choice of what lens to put on the camera is an artistic choice. It's not just a mechanism. It's a magical thing, you know, where it's like if I put a wide angle lens or a longer lens on the camera, that's a different artistic choice. You know, it's not purely technical.
Once you know the technical.
Well, yeah, that is it, actually. Yeah. I think that is, you know, probably a good thing in film school, is to learn the technical and like learn that cold, and then you know what the tools are in your toolbox. Mm-hmm. Then you know what you can play with. I'm sure music is the same, you know. It's I just remember when I played the trumpet years ago. I haven't played it in a million years, but like I just remember like endlessly scales and repetitions, and like, and it was just like so tiresome and dull. And then I was doing all this stupid stuff, like how to you know, blow into the thing with my lips a certain way or whatever. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And then you start to see that, like, once you know all that stuff, I mean, you can't really improvise until you know the dynamics of what you're playing with. You know, it's like, you know, and I think the same is true for filmmaking. The more you know, the more you can play, the more you can really express yourself.
Absolutely. You ever feel like directing all the time that you might lose sense of taking direction?
I don't know. You know, it's like
stand-up comedians, they have a one-way conversation all the time. And the threat of that is that they forget how to listen to somebody else?
Nah, because you're collaborating with so many different people. Like, I mean, a stand-up comedian, I would imagine it's incredibly different because it's you up there, you prepared your material, it's you and the audience, and that's it. You know, but as a filmmaker, you're dealing with the crew, which is a bunch of people with a bunch of personalities, and then you got a bunch of actors, and then you got a script, which may or may not have been written by you. So now you've got a writer to deal with. And then you're also thinking about the audience. I mean, sometimes I'll write in big letters, like audience, you know, when I'm playing, like, and I'll put it in front of me when I'm mapping out what I'm going to do for a movie or a video or whatever. Because, you know, it's like the audience, ultimately, it's going to belong to them at the end of the day, you know? So you're making it for them. So I see it as a service. So it's not just me and, you know, the audience, or if I were a painter, it would be me, the paintbrushes, and the canvas, you know, but it's me and a group of other people. So it's a collaborative experience. I mean, you know, and when I've assistant directed, I've heard, you know, I was talking to a director of photography recently and said, there's only two kinds of directors, good and bad. And there really isn't a lot in between. You know, it's like, if there's a good director, then they've assembled a bunch of people that they trust and really like, and, you know are going to contribute to the thing. But then they also lead, you know, you look to the person to see how to behave, or you look to the person because somebody has to be the one that says yes, no, maybe so, no, yes, no,
right,
you know, and they're guiding you down a road. And if you have a bad director, they don't know what the road is. So then, like, the director of photography and the assistant director might say, like, well, why don't we do this, you know, and then somebody else, and then we'll do this, and we'll do this. And then before you know it, there's no shape to the thing, you know, because there's not one person guiding it.
Right. Well, that kind of pertains to my question. Like, you have to be a leader.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes when people are leaders all the time, they forget how to, like, I don't know if you're married or not, we'll get to that, but they forget how to follow, you know, or listen to direction. Well, are you married? You have a girlfriend?
I'm single right now, you know, but I have been in long-term relationships, and it's, I don't know, you know, it's a tricky thing, you know, when you're, like, I don't know, maybe this is what you're getting at, actually, where it's like, I don't know, didn't Bergman say that great thing, I could always live in my art, but never in my life, you know, it's like, maybe that is a part of it, because I feel really at home on a film set. You know, like Sizemore, I'll tell a story about him instead of putting it on myself. You know, it's like, so on the set, he knew everything. I mean, he
do you
knew,
not want to talk from a first person?
Well, I'm gonna stick with Tom.
I see some sort of escape.
I'm gonna talk about Tom for a second, and by way of talking about myself.
I'm not sure, you know? Tom wants you talking for him. Well, I think he should talk for you.
Well, I am.
You're gonna send Tom back to Detroit to smoke some rock.
I am sitting on a couch right now. My gosh. So what was the question?
Well, I'm kind of comparing the two, because you are in a leadership role all the time giving direction, and then you have to, you know, somehow amend yourself to being listener, follower in a relationship often. It's another collaboration. And sometimes that can be difficult for people that are always in leadership roles to take the back seat.
Well, I don't know. I mean, what do you think, Matt?
Oh, I see avoidance. Don't answer him, Matt. He's just avoiding.
I don't know. You know, it's like,
I mean, right now you're taking, you know, I'm kind of leading this question.
No, it's a great question. I mean, as you can see, I'm desperately trying to tap dance my way around it. But
maybe you feel more comfortable giving me a question.
No. I mean, maybe I would. I don't know. I think there's validity to your question, though, so I'm going to try to answer it. I'd like to believe that I'm still a great listener with the people that I collaborate with, because they're contributing ideas, and if they contribute a good idea, then I take it. And like I said before, like, it would become mine by taking their good idea. But I mean, you know, and I don't know, you know, I mean, like if I'm, like, I was just out to have a cup of coffee with somebody who was on your show before, Kelly Ray Legault, who's a good friend of mine, you know, I will you know, if I'm having coffee with somebody, I will do everything in my power to get it off of myself, because I'm really more interested in, you know, what somebody else has to say. I mean, I'm out there making movies, you know, and that's kind of what I do a lot of the time. If I'm not making a movie, I'd rather hear from somebody else, like what they're up to and what's going on with them, you know. I would much rather listen, you know, than I would analyze myself. You know, it's like I don't, you know, if I wanted to analyze myself, maybe I'd go to a psychiatrist.
Isn't analyzing yourself just you listening to yourself?
Well, I mean, I do a thing where, like, in every morning when I wake up, I don't meditate or anything like that, but, like, you know, I have a notebook and I'll, like, free write, like, 3 pages every day. And it doesn't have to be good. It doesn't have to be bad.
Is that the morning pages?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not into the artist's... What's it called?
The Artist's Way.
The Artist's Way, yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, I read that book and it's a little too...
Hippy-dippy
for my taste. I'm not for... I mean, that's not really who I am. But I did like the morning pages thing just as a way to sort of clear out my thoughts at the top of the day. Yeah, exactly. It's just like free writing. It doesn't even have to be good. It doesn't have to be stories. It can just be whatever. You know, it could just be me saying, like, I hate doing this for 3 pages if I'm really not in the mood. But it is a way for me to, like, clear out my garbage or my thoughts or whatever it is at the top of the day, or to focus my thoughts, or if I'm in the middle of writing something, I can get something on the page, you know. So that's a way for me to listen to myself, you know. It's like, I don't reread those things, but the idea of, like, putting that stuff onto the page is a way to, like, just connect with where I'm at and what I need to do and what I'm doing. So that's me listening to myself, I hope.
Have you been to a therapy before?
I have, but years ago, and it was great, actually. The guy was fantastic. His name was Don. I was, like, going through... I was in a breakup and was living in New York, and I was frustrated by a bunch of things, and I was just sort of... I don't know, I felt all messed up, you know, and you know, they're like, why don't you go see this therapist, you know? And I was very resistant to it. You know, the first several sessions, I was sitting there, like, with a giant wall up, being like, fuck this. Mm-hmm. This is bullshit, you know?
Why did you feel that way?
Because I immediately associated it with, like, sort of hippy-dippy, new-agey thought and psychobabble. You know, I've read a lot of books about psychology.
Were you born and raised in New York?
No, I was born and raised in Rhode Island, okay. Deep in the woods in the country. Mm-hmm. I was raised by my grandparents, who were World War II, like, stock, you know, kind of like, you know, it's like...
Yeah, that somebody, generation. I mean,
like, there's, that generation is like, if somebody's bullying you, then kick them in the balls, yeah. You know, whatever.
Don't go crying to your shrink.
Yeah, yeah, don't go crying. Yeah, so, like, there's a little bit of that, you know. But then, like, I don't even remember what the breakthrough was that enabled me to start trusting this guy. But, like, you know, I saw him for, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 years or something like that, and I really did feel the difference. And, you know, I mean, I felt like he was... The thing I liked about him was that he was... I mean, the exercises that he gave were very practical and very accessible.
Like, what, did he have you do the chair game? Where you put your ex or somebody in a chair and you talk to them?
I don't think I did that, you know. But that does sound fun. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure I played variations on that sort of game or something like that, you know. And
what was the game?
I don't remember. It was, like, a long time ago that I was in therapy. But I'm sure that we did some sort of, like, thing where it was, like, pretend that you're talking to that person or whatever, you know, and what would you say to them and what would they say to you?
If they have you do the chair game?
What would the eight... I don't remember the chair game. Yeah, I don't remember looking at a chair and being like, okay, Dad, so... You wanted me to be Steve Jobs. You know,
want to play it right now?
No, that's okay. All right, you know what? No, let's do it. Can you do it?
You want to do
let's
it?
Let's do it. Let's do it right now.
All right, let's put... All right.
You know what? Yeah.
All right. Who do you want to talk to?
Oh, God.
First person pops into mind.
All right.
Your
let's
dad
do,
or
my
your dad?
Ex? Yeah, let's do my father.
Your father?
All right, great.
All right, here's your dad.
Me and my dad.
What's the first thing you want to say to your dad? Jeremiah's staring at
this. I never wanted to be Steve Jobs, didn't want to do IBM. I wanted to be a filmmaker, and that's what I am now.
Okay, that's good.
Keep going. Well, you're the shrink. I mean, you have to guide me through the thing.
Well, you've got the black shirt on like Steve Jobs. So.
Yeah.
So your dad wanted you to be like some sort of
CEO? Oh, we are going
CEO.
Into this now, aren't we? Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
I mean, you're doing well as a director. Why wouldn't he be proud of that?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's like it just was something that he pretty clearly didn't want me to do. You know, like I went to NYU film school right out of high school.
A good school?
Good school, yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty good grants and scholarships and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, it's like I... But I know that he would, you know, I mean, he was like, man, you know, like, going into the arts is totally, I mean, I understand this perspective too. It's like, it's not financially as rewarding as working for IBM, you know? But I know that, I mean, I, you know, even when I did like a temp job, I felt like my soul was being destroyed, you know? So,
wait, you said your grandparents raised you.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
What, why, where was your dad? What
well, happened? I mean, you know, he, my mom had me when she was very young. She was 17. She and my father weren't married. I think she wanted to have a kid and, but she didn't want to get married. So she had me and was like, you know, sorry, I don't want to marry, I don't want to marry Jim, my father. And so he peeled out in the driveway and took off, and I didn't meet him until I was 12.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was your mom's parents.
My mom's parents. Yeah. And so I grew up with my mom and her parents. My mom was still real young when she had me. So she was still
In the house with you?
She was around. I mean, she was like, I mean, she kind of came and went because she was sort of, I don't know. I mean, she was 17 when she had me. So she was still sort of figuring out who, what was going on. But like, but so she came and went, but my grandparents, like, if they, you know, my grandmother still lives in the same house in this, you know, rural road in Rhode Island. So that's where I grew up, like deep in the woods. Mm-hmm. And
well, your mom still technically lived in the house.
She did. Yeah. So yeah. Yeah. So she was around, you know, but like the mother figure and the father figure were way more like my grandfather and my grandmother, my mom.
Well, you knew at the time that your mom.
Oh yeah. No, okay. I totally knew my mother was my mother.
Did she feel more like a big sister or a mom?
I don't know. I felt like I had two moms, you know, that was a funny thing. You know, it's like, I mean, that got a little confusing. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to call you Ma and I'm going to call you Mom so that I can just tell the difference between you guys. No, she didn't feel like an older sister. She felt like a mother, but like she was definitely like young and like you know, running around and like free spirited and stuff like that. Whereas my grandmother felt like really like my grandparents felt solid, mm-hmm. and my mother felt fluid. If that makes
and
any
you
sense,
you sensed that as a kid.
Oh yeah, totally. I felt sensitive. Like yeah, I felt like I was like, you know, I really like kids who are, you know, old souls. Like, I just worked with a kid who was 5, but it was like 5 going on 40, you know? So I think I was that guy too. You know, I think I'm 40, what am I, 41 or 42 now, one or the other. But like, I feel like I finally like, you know, it's either I've grown into myself, you know, so I'm finally the 42-year-old I always was, or I'm an immature adult who never grew up really.
So now that you're an adult male, was it your dad's choice to be gone for 12 years?
I think that my dad was reading it as like it was my mother's choice for him to be out of the picture. So he just stayed out.
You know? Do you have any contempt for that? Because obviously your mom can't make that choice for him.
That's true. You know, I don't know if I felt contempt for my father then or now because of that. You know, it was more like that was just the way the cards were dealt in that situation. I don't blame my mother for anything, and I don't blame my father for being super pissed off about it.
Was he around her age?
He was older, yeah.
A lot older?
I think 5-6 years older.
Okay, so not that much.
Not that much. I mean, he was still young, too, you know. So, and he was figuring out, like, what his deal was. But yeah, when I was...
I mean, could you imagine doing that if you had a kid right now? Just having a kid and being like, oh, the mom doesn't want me around. I guess I'll just disappear. And not
that's a good question. I mean, I know I don't want to have children, you know. So, yeah. Yeah, it's not, you know, I think I figured that out like a couple, like maybe a year or two ago. It's kind of like, oh, you know what? I mean, I always sort of said to myself, like, yeah, you know, if she wants children, then I'll go with it, you know, whatever. And then after a while, I was like, you know what? Let me just be honest with myself. I don't want any children.
This is with your ex?
Yeah, well, with my ex, I mean, well, the reason we broke up was because I'm a filmmaker, actually. It's like, I mean, that was the thing, was she was just getting incredibly frustrated by it.
She also wanted you to be Steve Jobs?
She didn't want me to be Steve Jobs, but she was I mean, like, she had her own stuff. I mean, she's quite a brilliant person. She's a great writer. Yeah. But she was just kind of over it with New York City and just kind of like, you know, I'm done. And, you know, it's like she just wants a little bit more of a regular life and a little bit more sense. Like she wants the countryside, a regular life, get out of New York City and be a mother.
How long was this relationship?
5 years.
Okay.
Yeah. She's a great person, but like, but it just we just reached an impasse, you know. It's just one of those like, well, I want to be a filmmaker. I don't want to have children. I love New York City. We can't continue. You know, it's right. like, And so, you know, I mean, that's how that worked out. So I'm single right now.
You don't want to be a miserable dad living in the country, regretting all your decisions to give up your dreams?
No, that's not me. You know, no. And I mean, you know, there are people I know who, I mean, you know, who've done that, you know, who like retired, not retired, but like they're my age, but like went off to the country, had a kid, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they seem happy, but like there is a part of them that yearns for...
What could have been.
Yeah. And I don't have to wonder about that at all. I mean, I knew what I wanted to do when I was 12.
But you wonder what it could have been being a dad in the country?
Negative. Because no, when I was 12 years old, I knew that like movies were the thing for me. I mean, like it kind of like when I was 12, like I knew before that, that I loved drawing and I was a child actor for a little bit. And, my grandfather would always read stories to me, and filmmaking combined all three of those things. And so when I was 12, my grandparents got this VHS camcorder. Mm-hmm. So I started making all these movies, and I was like, this is it. Not just that I loved the medium, but it was like, this is the way I feel most comfortable communicating the world.
Now, I see you keep looking at the chair.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like you're talking to us and your dad.
Dude, this is like the deepest interview. Maybe I am talking to the chair.
Yeah, well, it's also 12, the age that your dad came back into your life.
Yeah, 12 was a huge year. It was like the year I figured out what I wanted to do, the year my father came back into my life. My first brother was born when I was age 12. I was out of the country the first time when I was 12.
Our dads play such a big role in our lives, subconsciously. It's very strange.
Yeah.
I feel like people don't... There's no explanation for it rather than just some primal reason.
For sure. Oh, yeah.
So you said your grandmother felt like a second mom. Did your grandfather feel like a father
Definitely.
Figure to you?
Oh, yeah. He was the best. I mean, he was the father figure. He was an amazing man. He'd done all sorts of crazy things in his life. I mean, you know, he was a minister for a little while. He served in the Korean War. He was like a crazy photographer. He made like these weird sculptures and things like that. He was enormously supportive of like anything that I wanted to do creatively. And he was also self-educated and very well read. He was, you know, like, I mean, if there was anything bonkers about him, he was a little way too much into the French existentialists, you know, and like, you know, Sartre, God is dead, all that kind of stuff, you know. So he pushed that to an extreme. But I mean, but he was a vital man. And like, he died last year. He died last March. And, you know, when he passed, it was kind of an amazing thing because his memorial, he was really specific. He was like, all right, when I die, I don't want to be buried. I don't want a coffin. I want to, you know, just burn me, you know, cremate me, but then wait a couple of months before you scatter my ashes because it's the winter time. Here are the places that I want my ashes scattered, like throw it in the river here and here and here and here and there, you know. And it was, and it like was an amazing thing because first of all took all that, you know, that thing about funerals, like what would he have wanted?
Right.
He was incredibly clear about what he wanted. And then he was like, no funeral. So like, if you guys want to do something at a church, whatever, make it into a thing where people can talk. You know, so people can go up and talk if they want to, but no sermoning or no coffin there, all that stuff, you know. And that wound up being a great day. You know, it was like one of those things where like the mood of the room was not like, we are so sad he's gone, although there was deep melancholy. But it was like the vibe in the room was like, this man walked the earth. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And then I went out and filmed the very next day. You know, I had to go out and shoot some stuff. It was like the memorial was on a Sunday, and then I had to go out and film on a Monday and a Tuesday. And it was one of those things where I couldn't replace myself because I was hired because they... quote unquote, wanted the Jeremiah Kip thing, you know. And like, you know, they were flying people in from LA. There's trucks full of equipment. I mean, they couldn't push, they couldn't cancel. It was like Monday, it's happening.
Well, I feel like if someone lives a long life, their funeral could just be a celebration of their life.
It was a total celebration of it. It was a great celebration of his life. And then the next day when I was filming, I was just kind of like, I'm just going to carry that feeling with me onto the set. Everybody knew. I told the cast and crew, I was like, look, my grandfather just died. He was like my father. So whatever it is I'm going to feel today, I'm just going to feel it, you know.
That leads me to my next question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How much of your personal life and all this stuff and, you know, young mother, distant father, how much of that comes into your art as a director?
Probably
a lot. And a writer.
Oh, probably a lot, you know. Like, I know that when we were filming the stuff that very next day, it was like infused with my feelings, you know. So the movies for me are like, you know, some people write their memoirs or diary or whatever. I feel like mine are these movies that I've done. It's like whatever it is I'm feeling, you know, it's like, you know, it's like I'm going to show up on the set that day and infuse the movie with whatever it is that I'm feeling that day. I mean, so,
that's why I asked the question about listening, because writing takes listening. You're listening to the other person in your
writing. Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, you know, I did do one directly autobiographical. Autobiographical, no, personal, yes. You know, it's called The Christmas Party. It's up on my website. You know, that one has like grandparents and a kid and a mom and all this stuff and these crazy Christians who live in the neighborhood. And that was all stuff that was from my life, not directly autobiographical, but like personal, you bet your ass, you know. Mm-hmm. So, like, all that stuff went into the thing. And I'm sure there's stuff in the movies. I mean, I don't know if I sat down and looked at it, if I had father figures, let me see if like, or the male figures are this and the women are that, you know, or whatever. You know, I mean, I'm sure that, like, you know, my mom being like an Alice in Wonderland character is like deeply embedded in the movies somehow. I'm sure that my granddad being a Don Quixote is embedded in it. My father being
not even a logistical connection, maybe an emotional connection.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not directly, but indirectly, you know, I think these things are, you know, the films are filled with all this stuff, you know, and I think that's great, you know. I mean, you know, often I don't even recognize it until years later that, like, I'll watch the movie, but, oh, yeah, that character is me. And, you know, I mean, I watched, you know, or, like, that is my ex-girlfriend from 15 years ago. That's her. Oh, my gosh. I was using her when we were working on that character.
Isn't that great when you can discover yourself through your own art?
Oh, yeah.
Later?
Oh, yeah. You know, I feel like I discovered stuff about myself, though, when I saw that, like, a couple of exes of mine have been writers and filmmakers and stuff like that. So if I see like a character based on me in a movie or story or something like that, I'm always kind of, I mean, whether they're likable or not likable, I find it fascinating. I'm just kind of like, wow, that's her interpretation of me, you know? I mean, that's fascinating, you know? And like, sometimes the characters are not likable or whatever. And I'm like, that's great. You know, it's like, I never thought it was a bad thing. And like my granddad too, actually, like, I found his character that's sort of based on him to be like, some audiences like him, some don't, but he loved it. He was thrilled. I mean, the character ends on a very negative note, but he was thrilled about that too. He was just kind of like, that's great. Show it. Mm-hmm. Show everything, you know, like put it up there on the screen. I love it. I'm so thrilled that like, I'm like,
and
you know,
was the actor that played that character worried that they weren't likable?
No, he was cool. Because he was an older guy. No, he was an older guy. I told you, the older guys, they're relaxed, you know. In fact, he, like, hung out with my granddad a lot. Like, he was like a vampire, like, draining, like, everything he could. He was, like, sort of, like, if I were playing Matt, you know, I'd be, like, watching Matt for days, you know, being like, all right, I'm going to steal that from Matt.
Right.
This guy was like that with my grandfather. He was, like, my grandfather happened to be hanging around on that set. So he's like, oh, I'm going to steal this, and this from your grandfather.
What film was that?
It's called The Christmas Party.
Oh, the same one.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's a sad one because the two older people who played the grandparents are both passed away. You know, Pete, who played the grandfather, has passed away. Oh, wow. And Marilyn, who played the grandmother, has passed away. You know, and that's something, like, when you work on a movie, and, like, let's say you work with child actors, and now they're grown up, you know. Some of the kids from that movie now make films or work on movies. The two actors who played the grandparents passed away. So if you're watching a movie, you're like, oh, wow, those people are in the movie, but they're not alive anymore. I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing. Yeah. You know, that's interesting to consider.
Yeah. So what's next for you? Are you working on something currently?
Yeah. Well, there's the two music videos that I just did back to back. Matt was in one of those. We're in post on two features, a vampire movie called Teresa and Allison and the sci-fi H.P. Lovecraft infused reality, you know, found footage movie called Black Wake.
That's
one with Tom Sizemore. Yeah.
Cool.
And then there's a movie called Pickup, which I really loved making. It was written by a great writer named Jessica Blank. It was my first time working with a union writer.
You can't
writer.
Say her last name?
Blank. Oh. Yeah. very good. Jessica Blank, she wrote a great play called The Exonerated a few years ago. It was on Broadway. It was about people who were wrongfully on death row. Anyway, she's a brilliant writer. It was great working with her.
So you got a lot of things going on.
Yeah, totally. Cool. I love to work, you know? You know, and talk about being on the couch. It's like sometimes I wonder if films are like these epiphanous highs as a way to avoid actually dealing with reality.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, like it's like if you're living in a movie, you know, it's way easier to do that than to actually like, you know, like what? Wake up in the morning and pay your bills and like figure out like all that stuff. I mean, that stuff is cold, hard facts, you know.
You're spending your days in fantasy land.
Yeah, you're spending your days playing make-believe, you know. And there is a part of me that wonders, you know, it's like, you know, is that why... I mean, I don't consider myself to be a depressed person, but I can totally understand why creative people become depressed, because it's like, if you're living in an epiphanous high of creating something, and then you're not creating something, you're just living your life.
Yes.
It can never match the magic of like of playing make believe and castles and kings or monsters or whatever it is, you know. So
we're even getting on stage all the time. The buzz you get from performing.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. It takes you out. I mean, as an actor, I would imagine that takes you outside of yourself, or you're so inside of yourself that it's so deeply rewarding.
Or knowing the camera's staring at you.
Oh sure,
that's the buzz
for sure. You know, but you can't live there all the time. That is not a life. I mean, that is not being. That is an experience, you know.
You're just a junkie, really.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know, you know, it's that's I did because I was making a film about somebody with addiction, you know, and that pickup, the one Jessica Blank wrote, it was about a sexual addict. But I'm not, you know, but I'm not a sex addict, but I connected with it, this thing of like, no, the addiction is like making movies, and you constantly want to go back to making movies because, right, like, the reality of your life is so different. And that's the thing I tried to tap into with that. Talk about, you know,
bringing personal, your life.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, that was exactly how I did it, because I don't know what it is to be a sex addict at all. I mean, I did some research and all that stuff, but then I was like, no, but I have to relate it to my own personal experience. And that's right. How I did it was that thing we're talking about. And looking at the chair right now. You know, it's like, you know, that's a part of my reality is like is playing make-believe and then not playing make-believe. And then when you're not playing make-believe, you are yourself. And then that gets into a whole philosophical thing of like, who am I? Where, you know, where did I come from? Where am I going? And I think it's impossible to know oneself. You know, I really do think that, you know, it's like,
it's a lifelong process.
Oh, sure.
But absolutely. I do think you can know yourself. There's degrees. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd love to keep talking about it. I'd have to start charging you.
Well, this was amazing. This is certainly different than any interview I've ever had. So so thank you for that.
That makes me glad. And your dad's telling me something from this chair. He's saying that he loves you unconditionally.
Aw, thanks, Dad.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah,
fantastic. Great. Guys, that was great.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.